I want to open an illustration. I've used this before. I've talked about this before, but when I was 18, I moved, right after I graduated high school, I moved to the island of Oahu and lived there for 6 months with some friends. And one of the things that struck me when I went there is one of the things you see all over the place is you see these bumper stickers or stickers all over the place that say, Eddie would go. You see them sometimes here in San Diego, but it's really common to see in Hawaii. And I came to find out that Eddie would go had to do with this guy, Eddie Aikau. And there's actually a surf tournament, called the Eddie. It's the Eddie Aikau Surf Invitational on the North Shore. And it happens at Waimea Bay. And it's a really interesting tournament because it doesn't happen every year. In fact, it just has to be, the only time it happens is when conditions are just right, because the north side of Oahu is famous for surfing. You have Sunset and Pipeline, all these amazing surf breaks and surf spots. But Waimea Bay doesn't always go off. In fact, most of the time, if you go there during the year, it's actually pretty flat. But certain times in the winter, when the swells are coming in just right, that it can be one of the largest surf breaks in the entire world. It hits its wave. And so the conditions are that for the eddy to happen is it has to be 20-foot swells happening with regularity, okay? So a 20-foot swell means that the face of a 20-foot wave is like 30 to 40 feet, okay? So it's like a five-story building is the kind of waves that are breaking. It just happened last year, 2023, was only the 10th time that the tournament has happened in 38 years. And the way it works is any time between December and February, when the conditions are just right, they have a list of invitees that are invited to the tournament. I think it's like 18 of the biggest big wave of the best big wave surfers in the world. And when they announce that the tournament is actually the conditions are right and it's gonna happen, you have 24 hours to get to the North Shore of Hawaii. Okay, so wherever you are in the world, you gotta drop whatever you're doing, get to the North Shore of Hawaii in order to be there in time for the Eddie. I told you it's named after a man named Eddie Aikau. Eddie actually died in 1978. He was part of a traditional canoe trip that they were trying to circumnavigate around the islands on a traditional Polynesian canoe with a group of other guys. And one day into the trip, they hit heavy swells and the boat actually capsized. And so the whole crew, everybody's there hanging on to the boat. And Eddie said, "Why don't I take my surfboard? I think I can paddle towards land and I think I can find us help." And Eddie, unfortunately, he paddled out and he was never seen again. And about 3 hours after he left, the whole crew was rescued and everybody was saved, except Eddie was lost. And that's actually not where that phrase, Eddie would go, came from. Eddie was one of the very first, he was a great surfer, but he was also one of the very first lifeguards that ever worked at Waimea Bay back in the late 60s and early 70s. And if you go there today, because of the conditions can be so drastic, somebody just told me after first service, they said they were there, and when they were there, this young, fit running back, a college running back, was actually sucked under by the undercurrent and actually drowned to death when they're there. And as you're there, because of the conditions can be so dangerous, you see all these signs up that say, you know, swim at your own risk. And basically the idea is that it can be so treacherous, it can be so dangerous that if you get in trouble out there, if they send a lifeguard out to get you, it's not now you and the lifeguard could likely be in trouble, right? So it's swim at your own risk. They'll just, you know, we just lost one guy. That's okay. We'll deal with that. We don't want to lose two people. So, and so the lifeguards, you think especially before they had like wave runners and that kind of stuff, it was really treacherous to be out there. But Eddie was one of the first lifeguards, and Eddie would, there wasn't one time that he saw someone in danger that he wouldn't go out and swim. That's where that phrase came from. It came from these other lifeguards that would sit on the beach and see somebody in trouble and think, man, Eddie would go. We're not going, but Eddie would go, because Eddie had that mentality when he saw someone in danger, when someone needed help, there was something that rose up inside him that said, I will go. You know, this past week, I attended two memorial services for people who passed away here in this church. This coming week, I'm going to be attending two more memorial services. And when people die, it's actually a normal time to reflect on what is life all about. In fact, the Bible says this in the book of Ecclesiastes. It says, it's better to go to a house of mourning than a house of feasting, because such is the end of every man, and it's good for him to think on it. It's better to go to a funeral than it is to go to a wedding or to a celebration, because all of us are going to die, and it's good for us to remember that. It's good for us to think of that. You know, when somebody dies, one of the things you think about is your own mortality. None of us get out of this thing alive. All of us are going to, our lives are going to end at some point. And then a really important question happens that leads to, which is, what makes a good life? How do we decide? How do we know what a good life actually is? One of the ways you can think what's the most important in life is you can think, what's worth dying for? For Eddie, he was willing to risk his own life to save other people. He was willing to risk his own skin, his own life and limb in order to help another person. If you're in the book of Acts chapter 14, what we're going to read is the beginning of the Apostle Paul and Barnabas' first missionary journey. In the Bible, we get four missionary journeys that are told about Paul. This is the very first one. And Paul and Barnabas are going to start out, and this is what you might call a frontier missionary, somebody who's going to people who have never heard the gospel before. Remember, back then in the first century, this is probably happening in 40 AD, or I'm sorry, 40 or 50 AD, probably just 10 or 20 years after Jesus had died and had risen again and then ascended into heaven. And so they're going to people who have never heard about Jesus. They've never heard the good news of Jesus Christ. They've never heard the gospel. What they're not doing, though, they're not really going to like how we think about it today, where like you might go to a tribe living in the jungle that's isolated, that has never heard. They're actually going to go along established trade routes to port cities, to places where trade has already been. Remember, this is during the Roman Empire. One of the things the Romans are famous for is creating enough peace and enough infrastructure to build roads to facilitate trade all over the place. So it made travel easier than it had ever been. And so Paul and Barnabas are starting out, and we find that they're going to an area called Antioch. It's in what would have been the ancient province of Galatia, which is in modern-day Turkey, okay? So right there along the Mediterranean is where they're going, and they're going to evangelize and to share the gospel. We'll pick up the story in verse 1. It says, "In Iconium, they entered the synagogue of the Jews together and spoke in such a manner that a large number of people believed, both of Jews and of Greeks." Okay, so you remember that there's in the Bible, there's really two categories at this time of people. There's Jews and there's Gentiles, okay? Jews are the people who have the scriptures, they have the Old Testament, they're believers in the one true God, and then there's everybody else. All the other barbarians and all the other different people are all called Gentiles, okay? So here it says there's Jews and there's Greeks. And what you also need to know is there's something called the synagogue system. Now, the synagogue system was that Jews worshiped God at the temple in Jerusalem, but as you lived in other places and there had been a Jewish diaspora where Jews had gone out and they're living throughout the Greek world, is there synagogues, and those synagogues are buildings, kind of like a church, where Jews would come together and they would pray, they'd read the scriptures, and they would worship. And so here, Paul says, as he goes out, he goes to the synagogue first. Because he wants to, these people already have a knowledge, they already have an understanding of who God is, and now he wants to bring them the further revelation of Jesus Christ, that Jesus, the Son of God, the second person of the Trinity, has come down in the flesh, has lived a sinless life, has offered himself up as a sacrifice on our behalf, that you, your sins might be forgiven and you might be saved, this further revelation. And it says there that a large number of people believe, both Jews and Greeks. But, verse 2, the Jews who disbelieved stirred up the minds of the Gentiles and embittered them against the brethren. Therefore, they spent a long time there speaking boldly with reliance upon the Lord, who was testifying to the word of his grace, granting that signs and wonders would be done by their hands. But the people of the city were divided, and some sided with the Jews and some sided with apostles. This is a really important thing for us to understand about how the gospel works. Paul and Barnabas are going out and they're proclaiming the gospel, and many people are getting saved. In fact, signs and wonders are happening. This must be an amazing time to be doing ministry and to be alive, where it's just dynamic and revival's happening, and it's amazing. But at the exact same time, a lot of bad things are happening too. Some people are receiving the gospel, but there's other people who are rejecting it. There's other people who are stirring up strife and division. When they hear the good news of Jesus Christ, it's an offense to them. And they hate it. And so they start stirring up division and strife between Paul and Barnabas and the believers and the other people that they're trying to evangelize and they're trying to speak to. You know, it's important for us to know this is how it's always been. Anytime that you're going to stand up for the truth and you're going to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ, there's going to be beautiful things that happen, but there's also going to be a bunch of messy things that are going to happen. There's also going to be a bunch of conflict where it's going to happen. Jesus said, if they killed me, if they persecuted me, they're going to kill and persecute you. We should expect it. And so part and parcel with preaching the gospel is I have to be okay with the conflict that comes. I have to be okay with the division, with the strife, with the problems that come along with it. It says in verse 5, and when an attempt was made by both the Gentiles and the Jews with their rulers to mistreat and to stone them, they became aware of it and fled to the cities of Lycaonia, Lystra, and Derbe in the surrounding region. And there they continued to preach the gospel. It says that word came to Paul and Barnabas, hey, they're getting ready to put you guys in prison and then bring you out and stone you. And so Paul and Barnabas, it gave them enough time for them to leave, for us to flee that city and move on to the next cities along the trade route and continue to proclaim the gospel and preach there. In verse 8, it says, at Lystra, a man was sitting who had no strength in his feet, lame from his mother's womb, who had never walked. This man was listening to Paul as he spoke, who when he had fixed his gaze on him and he had seen that he had faith to be made well, said with a loud voice, stand upright on your feet, and he leapt up and began to walk. Just imagine you're there. Imagine you're the Apostle Paul, and you're sharing the gospel, and you're preaching. It doesn't tell, there's a lot it doesn't tell us, but somehow you look at this man who's clearly deformed. He's never walked his entire life. It's clear that there's something wrong with his legs and his feet. He cannot even stand. And there's something the Spirit speaks to you and says, this man has faith to be healed. And Paul, in this moment of incredible boldness, says, stand up and get on your feet. The man stands up and begins to leap. He leapt up. What an amazing miracle to see. Now listen, our church, we believe in healings. We believe in signs and wonders. We still pray for people to be healed, okay? There actually is a guy who's gone to church here for a long time who has a severed spine. He actually was in a wheelchair. And God healed him. He still has x-rays of his spine is still severed, and he's able to walk, okay? Amen. We believe that God is able to do miraculous things like that, but I want to be honest. That's the exception. It's not the rule, okay? If you come forward and you're in a wheelchair, I'm going to pray for you, and I'm going to pray because we believe God loves healing. We believe God has all the power. We believe that he can heal. And I'm going to pray, Lord, would you bless this person? Would you draw near to them, Lord? Would you heal them? What I'm not going to say is get up out of your wheelchair, stand up and walk. Because if I did, you guys would be like, Mike, stop doing that. It's really discouraging when people don't get healed. Because guess what? A lot of people in something like that, they don't get healed like that in a super miraculous way. That's just, if we're just being honest, that's the season the church is in right now. We believe it can happen. We pray for it. We ask God. But it's the exception. It's not the rule. But here, the Apostle Paul sees this man and says, stand upright on your feet. And he leapt up and began to walk. And then it says in verse 11, it says, when the crowd saw what Paul had done, they raised their voice, saying in the Lycaonian language, the gods have become like men and have come down to us. And they began calling Barnabas Zeus and Paul Hermes because he was the chief speaker. The priest of Zeus, whose temple was just outside the city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates and wanted to offer sacrifices to the crowds. Remember, this is a Greek people, right? And so they have what we understand today, Greek mythology. And the idea behind Greek mythology is that the gods live on Mount Olympus, but sometimes they disguise themselves and they come down and they interact with people. In fact, that's what a lot of Greek mythology is about. It's about these interactions with God and people. And so that's where their minds go. The people who are in the crowd that see this, they think, this is Zeus and Hermes. And the gods have come down, and actually the priest of the temple of Zeus, who's in the outside the city, he brings in, this is going on for a while, he brings in oxen and garlands, says, let's sacrifice to these great gods that have come among us. That's what the people's minds go. But look what it says, look what Paul and Barnabas say. Verse 14, but when the apostles Paul and Barnabas heard of it, they tore their robes and rushed out in the crowd, crying out and saying, men, why are you doing these things? We are also men of the same nature as you. And preach the gospel to you that you should turn from these vain things of a living God to a living God who made the heaven and the earth and sea and all that is in them. In the generations gone by, he permitted all the nations to go their own ways. And yet he did not leave himself without witness. and that he did good and gave you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. And even saying these things, with difficulty they restrained the crowds from offering sacrifice to them. Paul and Barnabas are going on this missionary journey and preaching to these people that they might turn from their idolatry. And yet here, in the midst of preaching the gospel, the people are actually going deeper into their idolatry, right? And so they're distraught over it. They tear their robes and they run out and they say, listen, men, we're just like you. We have the same nature as you. God has allowed you in his providence. He's allowed all the nations to go their own way and to fall into idolatry. But in his kindness, in his love, he sent the God-man, Jesus Christ, to come and tell you the truth, that sinners might be saved, that you might be rescued from your idolatry and rescued from your godlessness. That's the God that we have come to proclaim to you. And I want you to see this, because this is one of the craziest stories in the Bible. It ends with verse 18. They can barely keep these guys from offering sacrifices to them. And then we get verse 19. But Jews came from Antioch and Iconium, and having won over the crowds, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead. What a U-turn. Like, you know, listen, be really careful if you ever get that viral moment in your life, right? Where the crowds love you and people are enamored with you, because it can change on a dime. And here, the people, one second, they're talking about worship, and the next second, these men come, they turn the crowds against them, and they actually stone Paul. They drag him out of the city, considering him to be dead. Now listen, sometimes this, I think, can be lost on us in modern society, because we don't firsthand very often get to see the brutality of capital punishment, or the brutality of death, right? We execute our prisoners by injecting them with some cocktail of drugs in order to hope that they can just go to sleep and not wake up. But stoning is like a real Bronze Age violent death, okay? Neil reminded me last night, Neil and I used to run Sunday school together. For years, we ran Sunday school. And one of the things we did is every week we were trying to come up with different games and different fun things for the kids to do. And Neil especially was really good at it. And one time we came up with this game where we hung a bucket from the ceiling in the middle of the room, and we had all these potatoes. And so we broke them up, boys and girls. And the boys' potatoes had B's on them, and the girls' potatoes had G's on them. And the idea of the game was you had to lay down and try to throw the potato up into land in the bucket. And at the end, whichever the B's or the G's had the most potatoes, that was the winning team. And listen, you have to remember at this point, many years ago, and Neil and I were very immature, okay? And listen, I've grown a lot over the years. I've become much more mature. So if you're paying attention, you're laying down on the ground trying to throw a potato up in this bucket, and you have one little bit of foresight, you know what we apparently didn't know then, is the potatoes would miss the bucket and go land on the people laying on the floor on the other side of the bucket, right? So it's just this big barrage of potatoes going back and forth, and a potato thrown 12 feet in the air and coming down and hitting you in the face and the whatever, it's painful, okay? That was maybe the closest we've ever come to stoning, but here's what stoning actually is, okay? If you're thinking about stoning, Turkey, the Mediterranean climate, it's very similar. We have a Mediterranean climate here. And so you have really similar topography, you have really similar animals, plants, all kinds of stuff. So basically, the way you think about like Cow's Mountain, right, is that there's just rocks everywhere, right? And if you're gonna be a part of a stoning, you're looking for multiple rocks. Okay, it's not just one rock, but you're looking for multiple rocks. The first rock you're looking for is like a decent baseball-sized rock, okay? It's got to be something heavy enough to hurt. It's not some little pebble, okay? You're not trying to hurt the person. You're not trying to scare off a bear. You're trying to kill somebody. So you're looking for like a baseball-sized rock that you can throw with that's going to hurt when it hits, but you can throw it with some speed. And the reason is because nobody just sits there and says, all right, stone me, right? They're bobbing and weaving, running, trying to do whatever. And so you're looking for, and maybe you can dodge one rock, but if 15 people are throwing rocks at you, you're getting hit, okay? So you find a rock like that. Once the person gets knocked down, then you're looking for your second rock. Your second rock is a bigger rock, the kind of rock you got to lift with your legs, you know? And then you walk over and you're really picking up this heavy rock and just dropping it down and smashing a person. I'm belaboring the point because I want you to think about the kind of condition the Apostle Paul is in, the kind of trauma that he's suffering. That these are people that are familiar with death, and we don't know, did God heal him? You know, because it says that they stoned him almost to death. But then the next verse, in verse 20, it says, but while the disciples stood around him, he got up and entered the city. The next day, he went away with Barnabas to Derbe. So I don't know if God miraculously brought him back to life, but what I do know is he must have been very damaged by being stoned. It's not the thing you get out with scrapes and bruises. It's the kind of thing where you'd have a concussion or broken orbital bone, broken bones in your body. And so they're able to get him back into the city, and then him and Barnabas are able to go on and escape the city to the next day and go to Derbe. And this is what I really want to come at, is these next two verses. This is the whole point. Sometimes when you're reading the scriptures and you're able to see something that maybe wasn't obvious, maybe it's something you read before, maybe it's just like a little treasure, a little Easter egg. It's almost like the Lord shows you of something in the scriptures that is amazing. I want you to listen carefully. It says, after they had preached the gospel to that city, the city of Derbe, and they had made many disciples, they returned to Lystra and to Iconium and to Antioch, strengthening the souls of the disciples, encouraging them to continue in the faith, and saying, through many tribulations, we must enter the kingdom of God. Did you notice that? You know, if it's almost like Paul and Barnabas sat down and said, it's time to go home. And they get out the map and they say, how should we go? If I'm them, I'm thinking, let's take the long way around, right? Let's go the other direction. Maybe we can catch a boat, maybe we can sail. But the one thing I'm not doing is I'm not going back to where I came from. And yet that's what they do here. Having preached the gospel in Derbe, they made many disciples. They returned to Lystra and to Iconium and to Antioch. Iconium, where they wanted to stone them. Lystra, where they actually did stone Paul. And they go back. Why? Why were they willing to risk life and limb again? Why were they willing to lay it down again and return to those same places where they'd had such a terrible experience?
Paul would go.
Yeah, Paul would go. Listen, please don't try to preach my sermon for me, okay? No, I appreciate the help. Strengthening the souls of the disciples. You know, there was people as they had gone through. It told us the whole way. Every single city, there was many people who had given their lives to the Lord. There was Christians there who needed to be strengthened. These are little baby Christians. And Paul and Barnabas know that if they don't go back, what's going to happen to those people? You know, the Bible, Jesus said that, look, ravenous wolves are going to come in and try to tear apart the church. And so he wants to go back. He wants to strengthen these believers. He wants to strengthen these Christians. What's remarkable is in Acts chapter 16, we're now getting the story of Paul's second missionary journey. And it says when he comes back to Lystra, it says there's a believer there named Timothy. Now, Timothy, we know Timothy from the Bible because Timothy is the book that 1 and 2 Timothy are written to. He's Paul's son in the faith. And it's almost certain that he gave his life to the Lord and became established in the ministry and got his calling from that first missionary journey in that first city where the Apostle Paul was stoned. And so he came back because he knows Timothy's there and a bunch of other believers that he needs to minister to and love on, and he's willing to risk it all. Look, this wasn't an isolated incident in Paul's life. In fact, this was a semi-regular occurrence. Jesus, when he was first got saved, he says to the believer he's sending to go and disciple Paul, he says, I've chosen this man, and I'm going to show him how much he's going to have to suffer on my behalf. And the Apostle Paul did suffer. 2 Corinthians 11, he's having a conversation about these people who are trying to delegitimize Paul's ministry to the Corinthians. And so Paul says, look, I hate to talk about myself. I must be crazy to talk about myself, but if these people are saying that I'm not a true Christian, let's compare our stories. He starts in verse 23, he says, are they servants of Christ? I speak as if insane, I more so. In far more labors, in far more imprisonments, beaten times without number, often in danger of death. 5 times I received from the Jews 39 lashes. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I spent in the deep. I've been on frequent journeys and dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from my countrymen, dangers from the Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in the wilderness, dangers on the sea, dangers among false brethren. I've been in labor and hardship through many sleepless nights, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. Apart from such external things, there's the daily pressure of me of concern for all the churches. Paul so consistently was willing to risk everything to fulfill the calling that God had put on his life, to love the people that God had pulled into his life. And you're right, Paul would go. Paul had the mentality that he was willing to risk his life for what mattered most. And that brings us back to the question, what does matter most? What is the mark of a life well lived? It's a question we should all ask ourselves. We all just get one life. You get one chance. That's it. What is it that we're shooting for? What is it we're trying to accomplish? What is a good life? Hebrews 9:27 says, "And inasmuch as it is appointed for men to die once, and after that comes judgment." We don't get reincarnated. You're not being brought back. You don't get a second chance. You get one life and then judgment. It says in Romans 14:12, "So then each one of us will give an account of himself to God." You know what's going to actually be the mark of a good life is what God says about you on that day you stand before him. Every single one of us is going to stand before the Lord, and we're going to give an accounting for our life. And whatever is there on that day is what's going to matter. The Bible says that some of us have built in our lives, whatever we built, whatever the material we've built in our lives and built through other people is what our lives are going to be measured by. He says, some of you have built with precious metals and precious and stone and gems. And some of you guys have built with hay and stubble and straw. And it's gonna be tested by fire. This time about believers. It's gonna be tested by fire, and whatever doesn't matter is gonna be burned up. And whatever is of eternal value is gonna remain. And that's gonna be the measure of your life. And so what is it that's gonna remain? Is it your possessions? Is it all the money? Are you gonna stand before the Lord and say, "God, the stock market was good to me"? I promise you, you're not. He's not going to ask you how much was in your 401k. He's not going to ask you how comfortable a life did you provide for yourself and your family. He's not. Those things are not valuable to him. He's not going to say, you're not going to stand there and say, look, if only I could have gotten that next promotion. If only I could have achieved that next thing. That's what, nobody on their deathbed says, "I wish I had worked more." The thing that you're going to stand there on that day, there's really two things that matter. It's how you loved God and how you loved people. God is eternal and human beings are eternal. And the mark of a good life is how did I love God and how did I love people? Jesus said, when he was asked by a scribe, a lawyer, he said, "What's the greatest commandment?" And Jesus answered, he said, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself." On these two commandments, the whole law and prophets are based. This is Jesus saying, "Lord, what's the most important thing? What's the most important thing we can do in our lives?" And he says, "Love God with everything you have and love your neighbor as yourself." All of the commandments come out of those two commandments. And I want to suggest to you this morning, that if you say you love God, the best measurement we have of whether or not you love God is how do you love people? We easily lie to ourselves. We easily convince ourselves that, yeah, I'm a dutiful Christian. I never cheat on my taxes. I'm a very moral person. I do all the right things. But you could easily lie to yourself about how much you love God. The real marker is how much do you love people? The Bible says, you say you love God, who you cannot see, but you don't love your brother, who you can see, the love of God's not in you. You're a liar. In fact, on that day that we stand before the Lord, that we're going to give an account, here's what Jesus said that day is going to look like. Matthew 25:31. "But when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne, and all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate from them one from another, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats, and he'll put his sheep on his right and his goats on his left. Okay? The sheep are the people who belong to him. The goats are the people who are lost, who are not his. Verse 34, then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed of my father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. This is the day that every true believer longs for. It's the day that we get our eternal reward. The day that our master invites us and he says, well done, my good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with the life that I've given. You've been faithful in a few things. I'm going to make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your master. Then he goes on to say something really profound. He says this. He says, for inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. Naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him and say, Lord, when do we ever see you hungry and feed you or thirsty and give you something to drink? When do we ever see you a stranger and invite you in or naked and clothe you? When do we ever see you sick or in prison and come to you? The believers are going to be a little bewildered. Because what is going to be astonishingly, unquestionably true in that moment, that you stand before the Lord and that he's revealed to you in all truth, is that he has no needs. He doesn't need anything from you. One of the immutable attributes of God is he is altogether sufficient. The Bible even says, he says, if I had a question, I wouldn't ask you. If I needed something, I'm not coming to you. So to say, when I was hungry, when I was thirsty, when I was naked, when I was in prison, when I was sick, you loved me. And the people are going to not going to understand. They say, Lord, when do we ever see you in a spot like that? That doesn't even compute. And the Lord is going to say to them, the king is going to say to them, the king will answer and say to them, truly I say to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even to the least of them, you did it to me. So you want to know how you love God? You love people. You serve people. And that's the mark of a good life. The mark of a good life is that you love God and you love the people that he brings into your life. That's what the Apostle Paul was doing. That's why he went back. He tells us his motivation. 1 Corinthians 11:1, he says, be imitators of me just as I also am of Christ. See, it wasn't this thing that Paul just, it was unique to his character, unique to his personality. He said, I'm trying to follow the example that Christ has given us. I'm trying to be like Jesus. And he's thinking about these, in John 15, this is what Jesus said. This is my commandment. You want to know what the commandment of God is? This is my commandment. Love each other in the same way that I've loved you. There is no greater love than to lay down one's life for his friend. You are my friends if you do what I command. Now we know that Jesus laid down his life for us as a symbol, as a sign of the greatest love that there is. But he then says, do what I'm doing and I want you to lay down your life for other people. I want you to love other people the way that I love them, to sacrifice and lay down your own life. This is what it says in Ephesians 5, 1 and 2. It says, imitate God, therefore, in everything you do because you are his dear children. Live a life filled with love, following the example of Christ who loved us and offered himself as a sacrifice for us, a pleasing aroma to God. Imitate God, dear children. Live a life filled with love, following the example of Christ. I want to end this message with three ways that we can imitate God. Three requirements to love people the way that Jesus did. Okay, I'm calling it the three C's of loving people the way Jesus did. I thought it was cute and clever, and they all start with C. It's going to help us remember, okay? Alliteration is, like, I'm not very good at it, but when I find it, I do it. The three C's of loving people the way Jesus did. Now, I want to say about these three C's, these aren't the normal ones that we necessarily think of. Okay, because when we think about loving people, one of the problems, I'll just start with the first one. The first one is that to love people the way Jesus did, it requires conviction. It requires conviction. Now, one of the problems is I'm starting off and just even talking about love is this like this word that is so ubiquitous, it's everywhere, and so much so that it's almost lost any kind of actual meaning. Like, we love pizza, and we love Disney, and we love dinosaurs, and we love our mom, and we love our boyfriend or girlfriend or our husband or wife. And we just use love to, like, describe it all. It's like this just amorphous blob. And so when we say love, it's just this, it becomes this watered down weak. What do we even mean by it? And the other thing is that love is not good in and of itself. You can love what is wrong. 1 John says, if you love the world, do not love the world or the things in the world. If you love the world, the love of God is not in you. Love is not in a vacuum. It's not just its own good thing. Love has to be connected with things around it. And the reality is that love, to love the way that Jesus did, it has to be connected with the truth. Love and truth have to go together. And if you divorce love from truth, which we have done in our society, it makes love something toxic and something damaging. You drive around the city and you'll see people with bumper stickers say, love wins. It's part of the human rights campaign. What do they mean by that? What they mean by love wins is it's LGBTQ, whatever, acceptance and gay marriage and all that kind of stuff. And they think that's what love is and that's love wins. Because they divorced love from the truth and the reality that God is love. And not some deist God who just does whatever you want and is your fairy godmother and looks like Santa Claus. Not that God, the real God, the living God, the maker of heaven and earth, the one who created you in his image, the one who you have rebelled and sinned against, and the one who sent his own son to pour out his own blood that you might be reconciled to him. That's the God. That's the God that loves you. So if we're going to love people the way that Jesus did, it has to be connected to that. It has to be in the context of the deepest love. It's not acceptance. It's not, we all know people who have loved us well. And we think about love, just somebody who's just always there and wants to hug. I don't know if you were walking through the hallway and you saw the Apostle Paul, if you're going to run up and give him a hug every week. You're probably like, that guy's intense. Like, he feels very serious. And yet that's the guy who is willing to lay his own life down so that you might have this imperishable truth that might rescue your soul from damnation. Is he's loving people that way. That's what true love is. That's what real love is. It's not this fuzzy emotion. It's a decision to lay down your life for somebody else. It's a conviction of what the truth really is. So first, to love people the way Jesus did, you have to have conviction of the truth. Conviction that your love has to be attached to truth. The second thing is it's going to require commitment. Jesus' love is sacrificial. It costs him something to love you. That's how love works. You know, the other side of it is if you just have truth, truth is not just this cold hammer that you can hit people over the head with. Truth has to be connected with love. It has to be connected with affection. And it has to require something in you that's willing to sacrifice yourself. You know, one of the things that is so frustrating about the world is we have all these inventions and technology and distractions all around us, right? We have these phones that are supposed to make our lives more productive and easier and slow things down. It has done none of that. It's just created all this more information for us to take in. It's watered down life. And I see kids today who have just been brought up without any barriers or any parameters, and they're sitting next to each other texting each other. And sending each other Snapchats and listening to music and watching TV and playing Donkey Kong all at the same time. And their whole life is just filled with just this digital nonsense, this digital distraction, amusement. And listen, you're never going to really be able to love people in a sacrificial way if your life is consumed with yourself. If your life is consumed with entertainment or just whatever is distraction. It requires you to lay aside your own wants, your own agenda, your own schedule, your own desires, and to actually lay down your life on someone else's behalf. So it requires commitment. And the third thing it requires courage. To have that kind of love that is connected to the truth, that has the conviction of truth, but also has a commitment of sacrifice, of laying down your life, it also now is going to take you some courage. Because to stand for the truth and to love someone with that kind of love, it's going to be difficult. And sometimes it's going to be amazingly fruitful, and sometimes it's going to be very painfully, it's going to lead to very painful conflict and rejection. And it did for the Apostle Paul. Everywhere he went where he loved the believers and he loved the people that God gave him, it also meant that people were going to hate him. People were going to break his heart. People were going to walk away. People would receive it, and then they would reject it. And so it takes courage. It takes the willingness to stand. So all the time, you see the Apostle Paul saying, pray for me, that God would give us boldness to proclaim the truth. That God would give us courage and faith to proclaim the truth. I want to invite the band out here. So three C's of loving people the way Jesus did is conviction, commitment, and then courage to walk it out. You're reflecting back on just Eddie and his life, on how willing he was to put himself on the line for other people. And the way that's just a picture of the spiritual reality of the Apostle Paul's life, the spiritual reality of who Jesus in his very nature was, that he came and that he left heaven to come and be a man in order that he might win us, that he might restore us to the Father. And then he invites us to come in and have that kind of relationship. He says that we're invited to come and have the ministry of reconciliation, to share with Jesus in that. That we get to go out and love this world in all kinds of difficulty, in all kinds of pain, in all kinds of struggle. Not easy, not clean, but in all of its messiness, sometimes in great victories, sometimes in painful losses. And that's what Jesus invited us into. To be the kind of light, to be the kind of church that reflects him, that looks like him. Would you stand to your feet?